time for Culture Shocks with your host, Barry Lynn.
All right, and welcome to today's edition of Culture Shocks. This is Barry Lynn. You know, I do fundamentally believe that there are specific pieces of the federal government that are broken. It's not some amorphous, I don't like the government. You know, I do like government. I like governments that work even better. We talk on a pretty regular basis in this program about individual things that can and I think need to be done to get this democratic institution of a federal government actually working. I think there are two huge obstacles, though, to any of the kinds of structural changes that we sometimes talk about and that we're going to talk to Douglas Schoen about today. One is just a lack of passion in the electorate about some of these issues, even though they're important. And two, a sense of entitlement by politicians that keeps them from being interested in promoting some of these ideas. Douglas Schoen's been a national advisor and consultant primarily, but not exclusively, to Democratic candidates for about the last 30 years, a well-known commentator and author. He's out with a new book called The Political Fix, Changing the Game of American Democracy from the Grassroots to the White House. Mr. Schoen, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Barry.
Let me ask you first about something that you don't mention in the book, but here is something that most people saw last night on the internet or this morning in their papers. The way the Democratic leadership is apparently planning to resolve health care before the State of the Union address. Basically, no conference committee where you have senators and members of the House sit down and talk about this, perhaps even in a public way. But in fact, let the staffers of about a half dozen or so powerful senators and members of the House just kind of create a proposal and fix it and then send it to the House for a vote, bounce it back to the Senate for a vote. And if it has to go like a ping pong for a few minutes, a few days, a few weeks, they'll do it that way. It's not very transparent. It's got to be wrong.
Well, what it is practical. I'm not going to justify it. Yeah. I think the way you do, which is it's not the right way to operate. But the Democrats saw what happened when they did their negotiating in public, the Louisiana Purchase, and the Cornhusker kickback or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
And their attitude is, just keep it all bottled up and don't try to talk to the Republicans. They're not coming along. Just present the American people with a fait accompli. They'll either like it or they won't like it. That's the logic, but you're exactly right. And what I try to do in my book, The Political Fix, is explain why this is so bad for American democracy.
Yeah, because even though, frankly, I don't think that either version of this health care bill is going to do what I think it needs to do, and some of it may even be counterproductive. But nevertheless, I think this the plan that is most likely to emerge from this is something slightly better than if it had gone through a conventional conference committee. Problem is, what I like or what I think is only part of the issue. Part of the issue is the structure that gives a sense to the American people that they're not being taken. I know that Brian Lamb, the president of C-SPAN, has asked that all these negotiations be shown publicly, that they will try to find, using some new technology, non-intrusive ways to cover whatever this kind of deliberation is. I'm not holding my breath for that happening, but I think it's a heck of a good idea.
Well, of course it's a good idea. And I think, as you do, which is that the bill will probably marginally, we hope, improve the health care system.
Mm-hmm.
But the larger issue, which you're raising, is, goodness gracious, we're moving in the direction of a closed, secretive government and society, which is not healthy for democracy and certainly not healthy for America.
Yeah, and it, at a time when distrust is generalized, I've never figured out what the Tea Party movement is really about. It's against kind of anything that anybody is against. They just come together, a couple hundred of them, maybe 1,000 of them, and say, yeah, we don't like it. But it just, this tends to cause a festering of that attitude, even in people in the middle who just are trying to figure out what is in this legislation, how will it affect me, how will it affect my family.
Well, that's exactly right. And part of the Tea Party is a reaction against spending, but a large part of it is a reaction against closed, secretive, unresponsive elites. And that's what we're getting with healthcare. And even if the bill is better, we're moving away from a system of Democrats and Republicans getting together to work constructively and collectively for the public good.
That's right. That's right. And those days, you know, they've been waning in the past decade or so. But, I mean, this is really everybody's out to lunch on this one. There's no collaboration, no cooperation, very little discussion, because any discussion, of course, leads to enormous criticism, among other places, on the internet, something we'll get to in a minute. Here's the bigger question that I raised at the very beginning of the show. I've known Ralph Nader for a very long time. He does tremendously good work. I've known Bob Edgar forever. He's now the president of Common Cause. They are, among other things, good government advocates. It's just very difficult for them, I think, to get a passionate response to ideas, some of the very kinds of ideas that you have in the political fix. How about free airtime for presidential candidates to fix the campaign spending system for the highest office in the land? You support it. I support it. Great idea. Let's dismantle the Electoral College. Great idea. End gerrymandering. Great idea. But the passion in the debates politically come about guns and religion and abortion, even death panels that don't even exist. How do you move those other more important issues to the focus of American attention, short of dropping some kind of a, you know, civics bomb on the country?
Well, Barry, that's a great question. I guess it's why I wrote the book, because, you know, I've been at this for better part of 30 years, as you kindly suggested. And I just sort of felt that I had to say what I thought, and maybe it won't make a difference, and maybe nobody will listen. But you know what? I'd like to think if you offer some good ideas, and people like yourself who are thoughtful, well-meaning, and have an audience and have influence, take them up. You know what? We'll move the ball down the field.
You know, it's interesting that the idea... there's no more inherent interest in something like whether you should mandate gun locks on guns than there is on whether to dismantle the Electoral College. I mean, you can have an interesting and passionate and fulfilling debate about those subjects. Of course, people have to choose to do that. They have to choose to do that, which means the media has to choose to be willing to look at these issues. And so far, the evidence, you know, your book hasn't been out long enough to know what they're doing with it. But, you know, they're still doing a lot of missing blonde women in Caribbean countries stories, and that takes up a heck of a lot of airspace.
Well, what I was going to say is I call it the TMZing of America. I also would say that when we are obsessed with Tiger Woods and how many mistresses he has, we end up in a situation where the net losers are the American people, because these important issues do not get discussed because the mainstream media, frankly, is not interested in serious challenges.
No, and the truth is that Tiger Woods affairs, how many there are, or even, good heavens, did Warren Beatty really have 13,000 women that he slept with, and you know, was he making a record of it or not? This was before cell phones, probably no pictures. But this has these things have no consequence to Americans, the average American, to begin with. They might be interested in it like you are in a train wreck, but it has no legs at all.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, people are concerned with their quality of life. They're concerned with how their countries run. They may have a prurient interest in Warren Beatty or Casey Johnson or Tiger Woods, but fundamentally what drives them and what drives their day-to-day lives is unrelated to what's in the media on most days and most evenings.
Okay, so we've already identified it certainly is possible to be passionate about these issues. They're terribly important, crucially important to American democracy and to how most of us, normal people sitting around trying to figure out what to do with our lives and how to make them better mean. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Douglas Schoen. He's the author of The Political Fix, and he's been working as a consultant in this arena for at least 3 decades. When we come back, the other big impediment, once we get past the let's get passion into the debate, is what about politicians' own interests in not talking about these issues? We're going to be back right here on Culture Shocks. I'm Barry Lynn. All right, we are back right here on Culture Shocks. My name is Barry Lynn. My guest is Douglas Schoen, the author of the new book, The Political Fix, Changing the Game of American Democracy from the Grassroots to the White House. In fact, making it less of a game because it's going to be structured in a way that is rational and effective and efficient. Douglas, one of the things that you talk about in the book, some of the issues are, I think, no-brainers for anybody who looks at these issues objectively. Why are there super delegates in the presidential primaries? Why are there winner-take-all primaries? Why is it so difficult to get on the ballot if you're a small, independent political party with something to say? One of the answers, I think the consistent answer, is because the entrenched political system doesn't want this kind of stuff. Even winner take all, every governor and every senator wants the power that he or she thinks he or she has to deliver the whole state to the favored candidate and get points for doing it and maybe an appointment in the next administration. So even there, there's an inherent sense that the current system is healthier for incumbents, for existing politicians. So why even raise these issues?
Well, I raise them because I think they need to be raised, because ultimately our democracy doesn't work unless we have a citizenry that feels that it's at least in part responsive to their needs and concerns. And Barry, I think, as your question suggests, we're getting closer and closer to the level of anger and dislocation that will mean that the governing class will be ruling without the consent of the governed. And that's just not healthy for anybody, much less our country with our storied history of democratic traditions.
Issues like ballot access, which I think have been raised first and foremost by Ralph Nader over the years, either as an independent candidate or for the Green Party. But now there is this real possibility of what's being called the Tea Party, a kind of a conglomerate of right of center. We're not sure what the platform would be. But these folks are going to get really upset if they realize how difficult it is to get on the ballot in almost every state. And that might be the best thing the Tea Party movement contributes. If they do want to become a more formalized organization, they find they're shut out of everything from debates to even access to the ballot. They could be ticked about something that I'd be ticked about, too.
Well, I think, I must tell you, I think the Tea Party movement is healthy largely for that reason. I even think Sarah Palin is healthy for that reason, because these are people outside the mainstream who are raising questions about the legitimacy and viability of the current narrow two-party system. I may well disagree, as you would, with their ultimate aims, goals, and ways of doing business, but I support their right to get on the ballot just like I would support that of a party on the left or in the center. We need to have a more open and responsive system.
Yeah, it's difficult, though, to get those members of Congress or state legislators who have the power to change some of these rules, including rules about ballot access, to take the leap of faith in democracy because they have so much entrenched interest themselves. I guess that's my point. It's that you almost have to get some people in power to start talking about these, because citizens themselves, it's not impossible, but it's certainly difficult to eliminate superdelegates if you're not kind of at least associated with some people who are superdelegates.
Well, that is exactly right. And the politicians, as you well know, have one clear, unambiguous goal, which is self-preservation.
Yes.
And I'm laughing, you're laughing, because you know it, as I know it. Fundamentally, they are going to do everything they can to keep any interest that threatens their apple cart out of the process. And you know what? That's why we have to do everything we can to raise these issues in a serious and sustained way.
In what's the venue of citizen action? In other words, let's say people are now upset. You know, they've been listening to this show a few minutes, and they're upset about the fact that we've got ballot access difficulties. They've learned now that they're upset about other structural problems, that they don't like the secrecy of government. But what do they do? I mean, do they join a group? Do they form a group? Do they pick up pitchforks and bales of hay and march on Washington? What do you recommend they do?
Well, it's a very good question. And I recommend basically, and the book talks about national service and offering a degree of tax and financial incentives to support national service. So I recommend that people do whatever it is that they believe is going to help them make a contribution, whether it be a Tea Party activism, working for Barack Obama's political organization, or some particular issue that motivates people. Basically, in an electorate where half or more of the eligibles don't vote on election day,
right,
anything that we can do to mobilize the citizenry is to the good.
Yeah, one of the ideas that you have in the book, which I think is an excellent one and doesn't raise some of the issues about kind of national service bureaucracies that you and I actually may disagree about, but the idea of a $1,000 tax credit if you contribute 100 hours of work, volunteer work, to your community, that is a no-brainer.
Well, that's my feeling. I mean, look, I'm a believer in service. We may well, as you suggest, quibble about the details, but where we're not going to differ, I don't believe, is in the notion that if we get more Americans giving of themselves to make this a better country, it will be just that.
That's right.
And you know, I just think that we now have a citizenry that's become more passive because they see that it's probably futile to try to change things, and it's more difficult to be sure, but we've got to encourage people to get involved.
Yeah, interestingly, although a lot of people say it's futile, I can't make a difference, the experience of being involved in any campaign, whether it's to, you know, stop something in your neighborhood from coming in that you don't want, that's not healthy for your children, if it's that, or if it's on a larger scale to make sure that you raise enough racket about an issue that it gets addressed in the health care bill, it does work. People are listening. It's just that there aren't enough people shouting from enough rooftops.
Well, that's it. And we need to get more people shouting from those rooftops. And, you know, the Obama effort, if anything, proves that citizens can make a difference. I mean, his election was improbable at best.
You got it. Yeah.
And people did make a difference.
Absolutely. And the question is now, and the evidence is yet to come in, is it possible to take that level of enthusiasm and direct it to issues, particularly very complicated one? We're going to get back to that and more when we return on Culture Shocks. My guest is Douglas Schoen. He's the author of The Political Fix, Changing the Game of American Democracy, his new book. When we come back, the mention of Sarah Palin reminded me of possibly the one thing Sarah Palin has done in her political career that I think is an awfully good idea, and I was reminded of it going through the book The Political Fix last night. We'll be back for more right here on Culture Shocks. I'm Barry Lynn. All right, we are back right here on Culture Shocks. I'm Barry Lynn. We're with Douglas Schoen. He's the author of the new book, The Political Fix. He's talking about the ways structurally in which we can make government more responsive to the needs of Americans. And more responsive, that means to your needs, not the needs of the so-called special interests. Although when we come right down to it, as I've said on this show, special interests are usually terms, derogatory terms used about the people who are winning that you don't like. If it was your side winning, then they'd be just good citizens trying to force their government to make better judgments. We'll get into more of that in a minute. I said I had something nice to say about Sarah Palin. One of the things that was reminded, Doug, when reading your book last night, posting the state checkbook on the internet, that was a decision made by Sarah Palin as governor of Alaska, and it's an awfully awfully good idea because it helps people in that state actually gain access to the nitty-gritty details of what in the world their money is going for. If they see it's going for things that perhaps they didn't even know they were paying for, they tend to like that, and therefore they have less hostility to government in general.
That's exactly right, Barry. I believe that transparency is critically important, and if people know where their money is going and what it's being used for, we'll have, again, a better informed, more responsive electorate. And I also believe that when politicians do things that are outside the box that involve transparency, you know, other politicians imitate, and again, we get a better and more open system, and then, again, that's all to the good.
I was talking on the show a few months ago with a former congressman from Oklahoma, Ernest Istook. He ran for governor unsuccessfully out there, and we used to fight a lot about social issues. And however, we were talking about some of these issues of how the Congress could improve. He said that the Oklahoma legislature now requires that every bill be posted in advance for a period, I think it's 2 days in Oklahoma. And even more importantly, that any reference in those postings to other statutes, you know, like this displaces subsection 175A212, that you have to actually link it so people can see what law is being changed. I think that's a dramatically good, wonderful idea. Congress, however, although they kind of promised that in the Democratic leadership, couldn't even manage to do that with the health care bill.
Well, that's the problem, because what they found is when bills like the health care bill saw the light of day, there were increasing questions, concern, problems raised, and as those issues got raised, there was more and more opposition engendered. And as that happened, the Democrats said, this is all a good idea in theory. In practice, we want to button the process up. So I couldn't agree with you more and hope that we can move in that direction.
Yeah, because ironically, if you don't put it up that everybody can actually read it or people who are inclined can read it, then they have to rely on the often false misstatements of critics of the bill who take something that maybe has two or three meanings and attribute to it the one meaning that makes it sound like the worst idea in the history of the planet.
Well, that's exactly so, right. And rest assured, without vigorous debate, we end up in a situation that the extremes dominate. And I think what we're trying to do is be in a situation where we want there to be the broadest and most robust debate.
The kinds of ideas that we've been talking about for the last couple of minutes, the Sarah Palin put the budget on, put the checkbook of the state right on the internet, the idea of putting legislation up, requiring it to be up for a couple days so people can figure out what it is, what it links to, what it changes, good, bad, or ugly. Those are, in a sense, changes that allow the American people to get, or in the case of Alaska, Alaskans to get some vital information. There's also another kind of information, and this is one of those points where I get a little nervous in your overall fix, although I'd agree with 92% of it. You generally support an idea that I think Newt Gingrich had originally of requiring the reporting of every individual lobbying contact. In other words, not just fill out a form every quarter that says, yeah, we spent $40,000 and we were interested in these two pieces of legislation. That's what all lobbyists need to fill those out now, unless you're a religious lobbyist, in which case you don't have to fill out those forms. But everybody else does. But they don't tell you much and almost nobody looks at them. But is it not too intrusive to think that Americans can't lobby directly or through some association or organization they're a part of without having literally every contact be known to everybody?
Well, my feeling is that if you're a paid professional lobbyist, you ought to have your contacts released. If you, as a citizen, or I, as a citizen, decide I want to contact senator or congressman, I'm not sure that necessarily needs to be reported. But, you know, if I'm getting $50,000 from Procter & Gamble or Altria or whatever, I don't think that there's any problem with with reporting it. I don't think that's too intrusive.
What if you're working, though, for the Sierra Club, and you are being paid, and you're maybe, I don't know if the Sierra Club has a PAC, but it would be, at least in theory, an independent organization, but somebody who's an expert on nuclear power goes to visit, you know, Senator Durbin. I mean, he is paid. It would be a lobbying encounter. But I'm afraid it would actually chill the interest of members of Congress in actually getting good information. Might also prevent them from getting some bad information. But again, I worry about the chilling effect that would have on the speech even of paid lobbyists.
Well, I must confess, I don't see it that way. I think that lobbyists are going to do what they're going to do, and we're not saying that the context, the substance of the contact has to be revealed. But if I'm a lobbyist for the Sierra Club, mm-hmm. Or any interest, I think that the fact that I've had contacts is that's my position. That it's better to allow the contact.
But you would not, and we may just have to disagree about that one, but lobbying itself is not a profession to be dishonored, and it's hard sometimes. No, it's hard for me, though, to convince people of that sometimes, particularly when I was, I'd like to think, a good guy lobbyist. But you have a story in the book about the 2007 yearly COES convention, and Hillary Clinton spoke and was put down about a comment she made about lobbyists. You want to tell us that?
You know, she said that, you know, lobbyists were people too, and they are. And by the way, I'm absolutely convinced that it is healthy to have lobbyists. I just don't want to be in a situation where they operate in secret, or in a situation now where there are great restrictions on what lobbyists can do, and they can't buy a congressman dinner unless it's a fundraiser. I mean, that's
right.
Pretty bizarre.
Yeah, well, that's perhaps the best example of a current idiot's compromise. You know, when everybody says, "Well, we ought to do something," and then by the time all is said and done, what is done is something so ridiculous that it should be an embarrassment to both sides of the debate.
Exactly.
And that's a perfect example of it.
It is, indeed.
Okay, when we come back, we're going to take a look at a couple of other issues discussed in the book, The Political Fix. Douglas Schoen's the author and my guest for this hour. We've been talking about some of the systemic changes that need to be made. Things like, why in the world, here in the 21st century, do we still have an electoral college? Why is there so little debate about that? What are we going to do about the judiciary? And Mr. Schoen has some very, very interesting ideas about the judicial system, including why is the Attorney General of the United States a member of the cabinet? Doesn't that make said Attorney General, whoever he or she is, look like they're just kind of the hired gun lobbyist of the president on legal matters? Is that where you get to real justice? I think not. Talk about that and some other ideas about the judiciary when we come back for more right here on Culture Shocks. I'm Barry Lynn. All right, we are back right here on Culture Shocks. I'm Barry Lynn. Douglas Schoen's my guest, the author of The Political Fix, Changing the Game of American Democracy from the Grassroots to the White House. One of the ways that you, I think, could make the greatest amount of change and turn this really away from being a game in the worst sense to a game where people actually play in their real stakes and it's real integrity and honesty is a change in the judicial system. I mentioned before the breaks, getting the Attorney General out of the cabinet. Explain to my listeners what you think the significance of that would be, and what similarly should we be doing with people in the Justice Department around the country?
Well, look, I think we got to take the Justice Department as much as possible out of politics. I think I was troubled, Barry, and I suspect you were as well, by the politicization of the process during the Bush administration.
Sure.
And I don't say this to, you know, point fingers at George Bush or Karl Rove, though I think that's pretty easy to do if one would want to do it.
Yeah.
But when you see people in the White House calling political appointees saying that you ought to emphasize this issue or that issue or keep investigating this issue, it's very, very problematic. And we saw what happened with Mr. Gonzalez. And I just think that we want to depoliticize the process. We want to have effectively almost like a nonpartisan review board in the Justice Department, and we want to get the Attorney General out of politics and almost like the head of the Federal Reserve so that he is subject to the wishes of the political class but not necessarily politically beholden in the way that currently is the case. And, you know, I if you look at where Bernanke stands or Greenspan stood before him, they are certainly not immune from politics, but they're separate and distinct from it.
Well, indeed, and of course, there are other people in office who span presidential terms, and you'd even recommend that the individual federal prosecutors have a fixed term, 5 years, which would, in not every, but in many cases, would mean they were working for presidents likely to be in two different parties.
That's exactly right. And just the very fact that they would know that they had a term of office that went beyond the next administration would be, in my judgment, something that would make them feel independent and make them govern in a different way.
Exactly, because the pressure would be far less meaningful, particularly if they only had one term. And as a non-elected official, a term limit like that makes a lot of sense to me, even though I get a little nervous about term limits for elections. But let's talk about the other big component of the judicial system, and that is the courts. What do you do about the fact that the Senate, not just the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, but the whole Senate, when Republicans are now in charge, and occasionally this would happen when Democrats were in charge, although not nearly as much, just decide to block kind of everybody, every judge, even if they're approved unanimously by this Judiciary Committee, the Senate's going to not take it up.
Yeah.
Yesterday, we had a second opening on the 11th Circuit that covers Georgia, Alabama, Florida. It's very important. The first vacancy occurred about a year ago. It still hasn't been filled, although there's a tentative vote date of January 20th. Now we got two. There's only 12 judges in the circuit.
Well, I think we got to get rid of these holds that individual senators can put, these anonymous holds that can be put on nominations. We have to move forward with majority votes. We have to end these filibusters or these non-considerations or the use of ideology as a criteria to determine judgeships. I mean, it didn't used to be that way and shouldn't be that way going forward.
Yeah, and sometimes it means swallowing some of these changes. I remember once when I was actively lobbying in Congress, and I we had a proposal that Bob Dole wanted to bring up on the floor of the Senate, and there were two members of the Senate, neither of whom is there anymore. One is Ed Brooke from Massachusetts, and the other was Jim Abaresk from South Dakota. And but in a bipartisan manner, they wanted to block him from bringing up this piece of legislation. It was a veterans bill, and he didn't like it. And so some of us were negotiating this bill, and finally what would happen was every day either Abaresk or Ed Brooke would put a hold on Dole's bill. And then they would change. The next day, the other one would put a hold on the bill. And Bob Dole, as you know, had an enormous, could be very, very angry. And he was getting really ticked off about this. So finally, Senator Abaresk called me one day and said, Barry, how are you going? How's it going? I mean, have you kind of fixed this enough that we can just get this on the floor? And I said, Senator, you know, I think so. So he said, okay, we're going to take the holds off the bill. So he took his hold off, and Ed Brooke didn't put his hold on. And I got a call about 20 minutes later, again from Senator Abaresk, saying, you know what happened, Barry? Bob Dole's gotten so suspicious, he put a hold on his own bill.
Well, that says it all.
It does. But I'm embarrassed, in a sense, to say it, but it worked to the advantage. I like to think to the advantage of a whole lot of military veterans who wouldn't have been helped otherwise. But if the system's going to work, that kind of stuff should be severely limited.
It should, and the system is now getting worse and worse. And what your program is doing and what this book is trying to do is to raise each of the issues that perhaps individually don't get a lot of attention, but taken together, create a overly politicized, arguably unresponsive system.
Can we, as we end this conversation, but one of the things, of course, that's known, widely known, there are all kinds of horse trading, often at the state level, in so-called gerrymandering, where you carve up a state into ridiculously shaped or ridiculously populated areas, guaranteeing re-elections for some chosen person or party. And often, frankly, at the state level, the parties get together and say, look, you know, we'll make sure that we protect your guy X, but I really, we got to protect Y up in the northern part of the state.
Well,
how do you change
that? That's exactly right. We don't have competitive elections now because we don't have a real nonpartisan redistricting process in virtually every state except one or two. And we have, safe districts, and when we have safe districts, we get ideological extremes, and when we get ideological extremes, we get no cooperation in the Senate and the House. So it's all predicated on protect your own and the public be left holding the bag.
So, yeah, or wondering how those lines were possibly drawn to create those districts. Now, in the states that you say have a better system, how do you draw these districts in an honest, fully integrated fashion?
Simple way, a nonpartisan redistricting commission. You have the state judiciary, the political leadership get together and appoint a panel. They're at the balance of power is held by nonpartisan interests, and you know what? All of a sudden you get, as we have in Iowa, five or six competitive districts where in the past they had at best one or two competitive districts.
And it's done, again, when people kind of rise up and say, you know, this doesn't really make sense. And I would suggest to my listeners, wherever you're listening to the program, take a look at the way in which your state looks on a map that is drawn to reflect, first, your congressional districts, and second, you know, the districts even within the state that determine your state legislature. You know, there's one thing, we're just about out of time, but if I were to rewrite the Constitution, which I would be, I think most people would be horrified at the thought that I would have anything to do with that, but I would seriously consider having a one-house legislature like they have in Nebraska, so-called unicameral legislature, get rid of the Senate and all of its arcane rules and regulations and let the people decide through the House of Representatives.
Well, I'm not sure I'm ready to get us to the Senate, simply because it speaks more to the center than the House does. But I would tell you this, anything that brings government closer and back to the people is arguably a step in the right direction. And I can only tell you that I found through this interview something that's a little eerie but very reassuring, which is that a very smart and thoughtful man like you, at least 92% of the time, maybe 94% after this interview, agrees with me, says to me that I did at least one or two things right over the last year. So
you
feel
did
very gratified.
Indeed you did. Douglas Schoen, the book is The Political Fix, picks it up, Changing the Game of American Democracy, now available in bookstores everywhere. That does it for today's edition of Culture Shocks. I am Barry Lynn, and we will talk again.
This edition of Culture Shocks has been produced by Diane Robinson, engineered by Dwayne Davis, and the Genesis Communication Network technical staff. Visit us online at cultureshocks.com.